go to your nearest park, feed the ducks. And what I've heard is you don't feed them bread anymore because that's actually really bad for them, but they love peas.
No, fuck this PC culture telling me what I can and can't feed a duck. Hashtag breadcrumbs.
Duck crumbs? I feel like the hashtag could use some work.
Hashtag bread quacks.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Keith Foster, co-host, San Diego. How's it going?
It's going fine. And with me is Cassidy Robinson from the burning hills of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
There is a giant scary fire.
There's three giant scary fires right now. And funnily enough, I was going to bring this up. I was sleeping. And my mom texted me yesterday or the day before, and she's like, I heard about the fire. Are you okay? I didn't even know about the fire. I'm like rubbing sleep out of my eye, like frantically Googling. And then I see it's in Ventura, which is a good 50 miles north of me.
Yeah, it's a ways.
So I was like, I'm fine. And I sent it to her, and she's like, well, I don't know Los Angeles, but I'm glad you're okay. I'm like, okay. So then I went to work, and I was like joking about this with my coworker, and it's like, yeah, my mom texted me, and it's like, Mom, that's 50 miles away. And then my one of my managers walks by, and she's like, oh, it's closer than you think. And then I look again, and another one had started only about 12 miles away, over the hills, like when you go over Santa Monica into over the 405 to go to the valley, basically the whole valley, like where Mulholland Drive and all that area is just ablaze.
Yeah. That's super scary. I've heard about like a bunch of celebrities have had to like leave their houses. And mm-hmm. stuff.
The Getty Museum is right next to where it is. So I really hope that they contain it there and don't let any of the art burn, or at least are able to get it out.
Yeah, I mean, I would, because I heard about it being across from the freeway from the Getty today, and mm-hmm. the last I heard, it hadn't crossed the freeway yet. So I would hope that a day would be enough to at least evacuate a good chunk of the art, right? I don't know.
I guess, I hope, yeah. I've never even been to the Getty, so I hope it's still there. So, that's my neck of the woods. How's San Diego? Is it still intact?
We had an earthquake today. Because, you know, it's just the end of the world.
Sure.
Wasn't a bad one. It wasn't like...
Just a normal, small SoCal earthquake.
Well, I think there's a lot that I don't feel. Because mm-hmm. I think there's, like, little ones that happen all the time.
But right.
This one I actually felt at work. I was like, oh, whoa, mm-hmm. that was an earthquake.
I've felt a few, like not majorly, but every once in a while I'll get a feeling like, was that an earthquake? And then usually not. I just had like, was lightheaded for a second or something.
Yeah.
One night there was a especially big one that was like a few miles north, and it felt like somebody was behind my bed and pushing it. Like, that's what I thought was happening. I was like, how did somebody get behind my bed? Like, I was, like, so confused, and then I looked it up on my phone, obviously.
Yeah, there was a worse one that happened. It must have been about a year, maybe a year and a half ago,
mm-hmm.
that I was alone at home, and I was on the computer, and there was just, like, this really loud bang, and it sounded like somebody had broken into the apartment. It was just an earthquake. It was weird.
Something probably fell, yeah.
Yeah, this was much less dramatic today.
Right.
It was just like, it just sort of felt like someone was like wiggling my chair.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had those every once in a while. The biggest one I felt was when I was still in Orange County, and there was an earthquake, like the largest one recorded in X amount of years, mm-hmm. over in Whittier. And I was parked at a red light when it happened on my way back from a movie. and it felt like there was two people, like one on each side of my car, like rocking my car back and forth. And I could see the red light like dangling in front of me. And I was like, ooh.
But oh, yeah.
I felt actually more safe there than if I'd been in a room or a house or something where something could fall on top of me.
Well, yeah, except that, like, if something could fall on top of your car and yeah, crush like
a,
your car.
Like a palm tree or a light pole or something like that. So that's that.
Yeah, so we're recording a podcast about movies during the end times.
Yeah, exciting, actually. I mean, probably people would like to know more about, like, you know, if they're listening for posterity, if they're listening, like, to these as historical records, they'd probably skip through all the movie review stuff and just try and get those bits about what's going on politically and geographically.
I can't even...
Today we're going to be reviewing... What is the name of this movie? Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri?
Yes.
Okay, that's a movie we're reviewing in the main review in a Netflix homework. It's also a newly released film, direct to Netflix, also in theaters. The Meyerowitz Stories, New and Selected, by Noah Baumbach. But we do have movie news, and it is a doozy. Hold on to your seats, because some of these stories are cray-cray.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
Where do you want to start?
Why don't you go ahead. What was the one you posted about Quentin Tarantino? Read that one to me.
So Quentin Tarantino, apparently in the middle of the night, had this amazing idea for a Star Trek movie. And now he's in talks with J.J. Abrams about producing it. Mm-hmm. So Tarantino might direct a Star Trek movie.
Yeah, that's weird.
I mean, I will say it's in very early talks right now, so a lot could go wrong. Mm-hmm. And knowing Tarantino,
he's one of those guys who always has a few plates spinning. I mean, any working director does, because you never know what's going to get made and what doesn't. So it's good to have more than one project in development at one time, because you'll only get one of 10 made.
Has such a specific sensibility, and
right
at this point he has the clout to make the movies he wants to make.
Mm-hmm.
You know this isn't like picking up Gareth Edwards to direct Godzilla, you know.
Right.
This is Quentin fucking Tarantino.
Right.
And I am very interested to see Tarantino's post Weinstein career. Because you know he might not have we've never seen him really work outside of them, so we don't know how he'll work with other major studios.
Right. He made Inglourious Basterds, I thought, through Universal, but maybe Weinstein was still a producer of sorts. I'm not sure. I think Tarantino gets to decide where the sun sets at this point. I really don't think that's his, you know, as far as like his creative control, anyone's going to get in the way. And he's the type of guy. He's the type of guy who's not going to back down. I mean, he will go to the mattresses if.
Well, that's why I'm saying who knows if this will even happen.
Right.
Because I think I could easily see him, you know, saying, well, no, if I can't do it my way, I'll walk away.
If I don't get final cut, if you're not going to, you know, let me shoot my 200 page screenplay that's mostly just dialogue.
Yeah. And but it's also such a strange franchise, because Star Trek has a very specific sensibility of its own.
Which one?
Just in general, like
that's what I'm saying, though. Like Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams.
Yeah, but do you think they're going to have a hard R Star Trek about it, with people in space talking about hamburgers, telling these aliens that they're motherfuckers, blowing shit up and having it be hyper-violent?
Dropping the N-word every 5 minutes? No, I don't. I think Tarantino would... I think he could...
I think he could concede
on making a PG-13 movie. I think he knows what world he's in as far as that goes. I do think that his eccentricities as a writer, his postmodern sensibilities, the way he writes characters, the way he does dialogue, the stuff that I think he is not capable of ebbing. I don't know how that fits into the J.J. Abrams verse, and like where does he put the set pieces, those kind of things.
Well, I mean, we've never seen Tarantino do like a franchise film before, so that's why it's very curious.
Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2, but yes. But not a franchise.
But even that's different. IP. That's a franchise he created.
I was about to tell this story. Tarantino, at one point back in the early 2000s, before he did Kill Bill, he was in talks to adapt Casino Royale. In fact, yes, it was Tarantino who made the studios interested in doing Casino Royale in the first place. But just as we're talking about, his vision of the project, which his original vision was still going to have Pierce Brosnan, his mm-hmm. vision of the project was not what the studio was interested in, and you know they couldn't concede, and so eventually it went to Martin Campbell, who did it with
Daniel Craig.
But yeah, it was Tarantino who was originally attached, and the reason that we ever got a Casino Royale.
But even that makes more sense to me than Star Trek.
Sure, 100%. But I do know that back when the first J.J. Abrams movie came out, mm-hmm. The Tarantino was insanely over the moon about that movie. I think it was his number one film of that year when he released his little list.
Hey, it's a great movie.
Yeah. So I can see, like, as a fan, why he would want to get involved. And maybe as a fan, maybe we're not giving him enough credit as far as his malleability as a workman director. But that I just that's don't true. Think I that mean, what he that's what he is.
Well, that's why I think it's so interesting, is because we've never seen this aspect of Tarantino. And mm-hmm. I think that could be... If nothing else, it will be an interesting story to follow.
Mm-hmm. It might. What we might end up getting, I think, if this happens even in any kind of regard, is a Natural Born Killers type situation where we have the Tarantino screenplay that's rejected,
mm-hmm.
and then somebody else takes it and uses it as the base for a new screenplay, and we have like Tarantinian stuff in there, but overall that's somebody else's like, vision.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm expecting to mm-hmm. come out of all of this. But just for sheer curiosity, I hope we get to see how this goes down.
I kind of don't. If I'm talking about, you know, if I get to decide on this, I sort of don't need this either from Tarantino or from Star Trek. From Star Trek, I think, you know, I really like the last one. It's probably been my favorite of the three. And I'd like to see them kind of continue in that direction and just do these fun little adventures. I don't want a big, cumbersome, weird auteur's version, like totally derailing where it's at right now. Tarantino, who says he's only going to make three more movies, I don't want him wasting his time on something that I know isn't his best use of time.
Here's the thing. First of all, I think he only has two more movies, right?
Oh, well, he has this one coming out of that maybe is or isn't about the Manson murders.
Yeah, so Hateful Eight was his eighth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't he say he's only going to make 10?
You're right. So, yeah, even more reason.
So that's what I'm saying. Like, does he count this? Or when he says 10, does he mean 10 of my, you know...
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to like see if this would count as one of his, you know, series,
mm-hmm.
or if he gives it kind of a pass because it is such a major franchise.
Maybe because he doesn't count Four Rooms, From Dusk Till Dawn, which he co-wrote.
Yeah, but he didn't direct it.
No.
And he only directed a portion of Four Rooms. So I think he, yeah, I don't know if he would count this. So I don't know. I'm very curious about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know Star Trek Beyond, it didn't underperform at the box office considerably. So this might be our best chance of getting a new Star Trek movie, period.
I thought it did okay. I don't remember. I saw it and didn't care. Like, I mean, I liked the movie a lot. It was actually one of my favorite movies as far as action movies go that year, but I didn't care as far as, like, what its box office was doing.
I'm pretty sure the last two have underperformed what was anticipated, and mm-hmm. because I remember, like, Star Trek Beyond was a little iffy on if it would happen. So, I think the Star Trek movie franchise is kind of on thin ice as it is, which is a shame because I've really enjoyed this reboot-iverse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I hope that it keeps going. And I'm genuinely interested to see what Tarantino would do in a situation like that. So
okay.
Either way, I'm curious.
Okay, this one is a little weird too. More just annoying. Ridley Scott says that the new Alien movie will have fewer aliens.
Yeah, I don't think we need to touch on this too much. Mm. We've kind of had an alien-heavy year.
Yeah, for
as
real.
As far as the podcast goes. But maybe just, like, do a new thing, Ridley Scott.
Yeah, you know, I think probably the easiest way to have less aliens in your alien movie is to do less alien movies.
Yeah, just, like, do a different thing.
Like, jump ship. This thing is sinking.
Yeah, he's clearly not interested.
Yeah, nobody else is.
Yeah, ever since Prometheus, he's always been more interested in, like, this AI stuff, which is fine.
Yeah, like, do a movie about that.
Why does it have... It feels like he has to sneak it into alien movies, because they're this established sci-fi franchise.
Right, right.
That, for some reason, he got the reins back to. And so he has to sneak in the movie he actually wants to make.
Right.
And nobody wants that. Everybody just wants alien movies.
Right. Yeah, and so. Well, and then when he tries to do that, or tries to, like, shove it into his alien movies, then it always feels like pandering. It doesn't feel like he's even remotely interested in that, in the horror aspect of it anymore.
No, it just...
Yeah. Yeah. No. I say no. I say no on the movie. Like, I don't want less aliens, I don't want more aliens, I want no aliens. Stop. Stop it all.
I'm much more interested in his new movie, All the Money in the World, All the Riches in the World.
I don't know. I haven't looked into it.
The biopic that Kevin Spacey was pulled from.
Oh yeah, well I knew it was coming out. I don't know anything about what the movie's about though.
I'm just saying I'm much more interested in just him doing
something else,
sort of like one-off. Mm-hmm. Not franchise stuff, because there's just so much baggage.
Well, his not franchise stuff is pretty hot and cold, too. I like The Martian a lot, but did you see Exodus? Woo-wee!
No, I didn't. But that's what I mean. Like, so you saw Exodus, you didn't like it. Cool, fine.
Yeah.
You're done. It was just not a good movie.
Yeah, he's not going to make three more.
Yeah, there's no necessarily emotional investment with how well it is or does.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a movie.
Yeah.
Ridley Scott's the point in his career where, you know, he's like fucking 80, mm-hmm. right? He should stop focusing on franchise stuff and just focus on, like, telling a good story and making a good movie.
Yeah, there's an argument to be made that Ridley Scott is never been the, like, a tour that some people have made him out to be, just because he had a few good movies in there.
I think you could make a strong case for that.
I mean, I'm not saying he's a bad director. I like a lot of his work. And he has a visual style and everything, but I do think that he is I don't even know how to make a really good comparison. I think that he makes really austere, well-made schlock a lot of the time, and I think once in a while an actually good he's definitely a director who's beholden to his screenplays, and every once in a while he'll get a good screenplay and he can bring his visual thing to it and it's in harmony, but a lot of the times
I agree with that.
Okay, are you sitting for this one?
We have two left. I don't know which one it is, because they're both...
This one's going to be the last one. Ryan Reynolds to star in the Pokemon movie Detective Pikachu as Pikachu, the voice of Pikachu.
So is this like a Vin Diesel thing? Like as Groot?
I could read you what the article says. It says that they're looking into motion capture. The actor will join Justice Smith, who was recently seen in the Jumanji movie. Speaking of Vin Diesel, or no, that's The Rock. Never mind, wrong person.
Racist.
And Catherine Newton, who was in Big Little Lies. But it says here, because I had to know, like, I apparently this is a thing that's been going on in the games for a while. Rob Letterman, who did the Goosebumps movie that nobody cared about, is directing. And it says, many details of the project are being kept off-grid, including the casting, which has been conducted under the radar by Legendary. But it says, the company has high hopes for the future project as the Pokemon franchise is sold, blah, 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 blah. That's not that interesting. So Pikachu is a species of Pokemon, while Detective Pikachu, the character, is a peculiar sort of Pikachu set, a self-styled investigator who is good at finding things. Reynolds will be portraying the titular detective. The story is kicked into gear when Smith's character's father is kidnapped, forcing the teen to team up with Pikachu in order to find him. Newton will play a sassy journalist who helps them on their quest. Are you ready?
Yeah, that sounds bonkers, but I'm not opposed to it.
This is drugs. This might reach like Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, Space Jam level unintentional weirdness.
Yeah. No, I'm okay with that. Look, here's the thing. I appreciate risks.
Mm-hmm.
Is Detective Pikachu like a game?
Maybe it's a side quest you can go on in one of the later like Pokemon games. I don't know.
Well, I'm Googling this because I gotta know more.
I mean, there's a picture here of Pikachu with a detective hat, so it's a thing somewhere.
Okay. Here's what the Wikipedia says. Metanite Pikachu Shinkombi Tanjo, commonly referred to as Great Detective Pikachu outside of Japan. It's a spin-off Pokemon adventure game where Pikachu... the people work with a talking Pikachu to solve mysteries. So the Pikachu... Detective Pikachu does talk.
Okay. Get this. And this might really weird you out. There was an online campaign for a little while that they're going to do this Detective Pikachu movie to have Danny DeVito do the voice.
Oh my god!
Now, this is weird only to us right now at this very moment, but I'll fill in the listeners. There's an ongoing inside joke between you and me since childhood to inappropriately cast Danny DeVito in like any kind of role. Batman.
As Spider-Man. But the joke was always for a role where it would be inappropriate.
Yes, inappropriately casting.
I think Danny DeVito as Pikachu would be amazing.
Inspired.
I actually, now that I know that Pikachu talks, mm-hmm. that Detective Pikachu talks, I'm actually so not on board with it being Ryan Reynolds. Because he's going to be too Ryan Reynolds about it. He's going to be like little Deadpool that shoots lightning. Right. I don't need that. If it was more like a George Clooney South Park dog or Vin Diesel.
Will Diesel's my new porn name.
If it was, you know, like a Vin Diesel recording. Hundreds of readings of him saying I am Groot, mm-hmm. then I'm on board with it being Ryan Reynolds. If it's talking sassy Pikachu, fuck that, that's boring. You can do better, Hollywood.
It's not very inspired. Yeah, I agree.
Give
with
me Danny DeVito Chu.
Mm-hmm. So you're on board with this like Reddit train of trying to get this to happen.
Yes, that would be incredible.
Alright, well I think they've made their choice, but you know, call your senator.
Yeah, because that works. Because, you know, the government isn't a sham and God is real.
And that's the movie news. Let's go ahead and get into the review of the week, which is Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. And I'll let you describe that. What's happening in this movie?
Frances McDormand is playing this mother who's... daughter was brutally raped and murdered, and this takes place about a year or so after this crime has happened, and mm-hmm. nothing has happened to her satisfaction. There's been no arrests, no leads on the suspects, nothing. And she feels like the local police have kind of forgotten about the case and moved on. But she hasn't, because how the fuck could you?
Right.
And so she rents out these three billboards that are, they're unused. And I can't remember exactly what they say, but they basically, and I don't want to spoil that, because that's actually a pretty great moment in the movie where you right. first get to read them. But it basically calls out the police chief, for the job, basically an impossible job not having been completed yet.
Right.
And so then there's, it's kind of a sparring of, wits and will between this mother and the local police.
Right. Woody Harrelson playing the police chief, Willoughby, and Sam Rockwell working under him as, Officer Dixon. We don't have first names here on IMDb, apparently.
You know, now that you mention it, I don't remember a lot of first names in the movie. I think Willoughby, wasn't his name William?
Will.
I don't know, they always just called him Willoughby.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not remembering off the top of my head, but, this is a large cast. I mean, we only mentioned two, but, Caleb Laundrie Jones plays a squirrely, I don't know, local groundskeeper, whatever it is that you would pay somebody to have billboards made, whatever the title of that is. And from Lady Bird, the same actor who played Lady Bird's gay lover.
I think it's Lucas Hedges. Yeah.
Who was really good in that, and shows up and is really good in this as well. This is written and directed by Martin McDonagh, who previously did In Bruges, which was nominated for Best Screenplay back then in 2008 or whatever it was, and Seven Psychopaths. So this is his third film thus far. And the first one he's done that I think, you know, Seven Psychopaths took place in Hollywood and had a lot to do with sort of the movie industry and sort of a meta take on that. But this one really feels like he's throwing his hat in the ring of, like, the great American crime story. You know, like obviously Francis McDormand, the lead, the rural setting, the kind of humor he brings to the tragedy, you're going to get flashes of Coen Brothers' greatest hits. And I think he's sort of channeling a lot of Coen here. What did you think of the movie as a whole?
As a whole, I was really in it. I mean, this is kind of an actor's showcase,
sure,
and it doesn't disappoint. Francis McDormand is incredible, as always. Sam Rockwell is great, as always. Woody Harrelson plays himself, but to the, like,
to good effect.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely playing to type, but it's, I think, really needed for the script. I really enjoyed it. Plus, I'm a sucker for, you know, I'm just a sucker for this kind of dark Americana crime noir,
right,
in general anyway. Yeah. So it's definitely, like, playing to me as an audience, and I think he pulls it off well. It's an interesting premise. And I think pretty well directed and pretty well written. I did have a couple tiny issues with it, because it's an actor's showcase. If any of the actors, or in this case actresses, don't show up, it kind of sticks out like a sore thumb. I'm referring to Willoughby's wife.
Right.
I sort of felt like she was from and in an entirely different movie.
And she's only in a couple scenes. I'm trying to find, what was her name? She was in, we recently reviewed on an episode you weren't on, that movie The Babysitter. She was the lead in that.
Is it Abby Cornish?
No. You're right. Abby Cornish, the British actress, yeah, she played Willoughby's wife. The I got confused. The one who played the babysitter was what played John Hawks's wife. John Hawks being the ex husband of Frances McDormand.
No, she didn't like she was played to humor.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought pretty well. But specifically Abby Cornish, I felt like she, a lot of the humor in her dialogue was lost because she seemed like she was just trying to play it too dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt, her role in particular felt pretty flat for me. And I also thought it was weird that she's like this one British person in a very American movie and it's not addressed or I don't know. It just stood out as very strange to me.
Yeah, there's a few things like that in the movie where you are jolted into being reminded that this director writer is not from America.
Yeah.
And that being one of them, some of the casting choices. I think actually, and Samantha Weaving is who played Penelope, John Hawks's girlfriend or wife. Younger, newer wife. She, I would say, is similarly weird and miscast in the movie. She's kind of played just to be cheesecake, essentially, mm-hmm, and she doesn't have a whole lot to do. But I'll say this about the movie as a whole. I enjoyed it immensely. I think it's really good. I think this is a huge step up for Martin McDonagh as far as ambition goes. He's definitely, mm-hmm, he's kind of growing out of that sort of mini Tarantino land. You know, he was as far as that goes, he was a big fish in a little pond. And now, mm-hmm, that he's trying to kind of like grow out of that, and he's trying to see what else he can do outside of that realm. Now I'm feeling like he's somewhere new. He's on another level. You can feel that jump in ambition for sure. But I also feel like there's a lot of growing pains getting there. And I think that some of his older sensibilities, that's a little bit more beholden to style and getting a laugh in during certain scenes, or like trying to turn a certain type of scene that we've seen in a lot of crime movies on its ear. Like these type of things that kind of come from that other style, I think grind on the gears a little bit of the tragedy that hangs over what's going on throughout the rest of the movie. And which isn't to say that I want the movie to be totally serious, 100%, you know, dour the whole time. And a lot of the humor does work, but when it doesn't, it really doesn't. And I think even some of the stuff with Sam Rockwell, who gives a great performance, and I love his arc in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Some moments with him, like some character choices, like this, you know, he's like leafing through comic books that's never really kind of addressed in any kind of interesting way. It's just sort of a quirk. And there's some stuff that he feels a little cartoony every once in a while.
I didn't have a problem with any of that because I felt like it was just trying to instill the fact that he's, you know, just kind of at the start of the movie, he doesn't really take his job very seriously. And, mm-hmm, and I think it was just sort of a supporting detail of that it didn't bother me. I will agree with you. There were a couple moments of humor that just rubbed a little raw. But overall,
I'll describe one scene that I think is a microcosm for what I saw as a problem throughout.
I think I already know the scene you're going to describe, but continue.
There's a scene that's a fairly seriously played scene that informs a lot about the characters, and it's well directed and it's well, you know, well executed scene of dialogue where John Hawks comes to go visit. Yes, obviously.
This is the exact scene I was talking about because there's all this tension and it's sort of interrupted for a joke. And
a joke that's very inappropriately placed. And I feel like what we're seeing there is Martin McDonagh losing confidence in his ability to play it straight. And I think every once in a while he thinks he's like, oh boy, I'm really going there. Because, you know, we end the scene, or the scene is sort of on this point where, you know, John Hawks has Francis McDormand pinned to a wall and, you know, their son with a knife to his neck. And it's this moment of real tension. It ratchets up quite quickly, and it's real. And then all of a sudden he brings in the girlfriend character who makes a joke about whether or not she can go pee in the house. And it sort of deflates everything. And I felt like there's a more interesting way to close out the scene. I feel like there's a more it just didn't feel real to the movie. I think all the stuff with Peter Dinklage is kind of that. I think
I felt like he in general was just underutilized because he's so talented,
right?
And he also doesn't have a lot to do. And
he brings a character there. I mean, there's not a lot for him to do on the page, but I think that Dinklage is so good that he actually brings, you know, some pathos to this kind of ridiculous character.
Pretty one-dimensional character.
Yeah, he's essentially a punchline throughout the movie, and I'm almost sort of surprised he did the movie, considering. And it feels like I'm beating up on the movie, but I'm the only reason I'm criticizing it as much as I am is because I think the movie is so great when it's great.
Yeah, I agree completely. It was like, it was just like a couple missed notes in a symphony.
Mm-hmm.
Because I honestly, for the most part, this was one of my favorite movies of the year.
Me too. I have such a complicated relationship with it because I just want to go in there and like tweak it, but it's so risky, and I love the ending so much, and I love the
oh my god, the ending.
Some of these character arcs are so interesting because we kind of, like what we said about Lady Bird last week, we go in thinking the characters are one thing and we find out more about them. And there's some real, real warmth and humanity in here that you don't see in Seven Psychopaths, which is probably so far McDonough's most style over substance thing he's done.
Yeah, I would say that's his broadest.
Which is a movie I enjoy, but for completely different reasons. This one, it has Oscar clips in it. You know what I mean? Like it has really strong performances, and it's really well shot. Like if he's channeling Cohen, he's doing it pretty well. There's those moments that I'm just like, don't do that.
See, I definitely agree with you, but to me they weren't enough. I've forgiven a lot more in other movies, I feel like. I feel like it is just so nitpicky. Like overall I really enjoyed it, and it's such a good character movie. And it's such a good, and there's some genuine like twists and real tense moments that I'm just there were moments where I was like gripping my armrest just with tension. For the most part, the movie worked a lot more for me than it didn't. So I'm willing to forgive it some idiosyncratic errors.
I would too. I when I'm walking out of the movie, I was a little bit more sort of in a place where I was weighing the pluses versus the minuses, where I was like, I like this a lot, but this was weird. I like this a lot, but that was weird. And so I wasn't sure how I felt about it altogether. But then it was more the days after, when I'm still thinking about it, and I'm still thinking about it on a story level.
Yeah, this one kind of sticks to your guts.
Yeah, and then I realized this is actually a great film. And this is the type of movie that we saw a lot of in like the year-end sort of stuff back in the 90s, but not so much anymore. Like this, it's a prestige film, but it's not the type that's for the snowball audience. Like it isn't just made for geriatrics.
It actually has some pretty challenging things to say about anger and violence and forgiveness.
Grief. Yeah.
Like you said, see, to me, I think it was the ending. It just sticks the landing so well. Because there were moments near the end where I was like, oh god, where's this going? And then it does the exact right thing that I'm like, oh perfect. Like,
yeah.
Like, just perfect. So, you know, I'm willing to forgive a lot more of the little quirks and complications.
Mm-hmm.
Because it thematically, it was so on point. And
right. Like, is it possible for a movie to be a B-minus and also be one of my favorite movies of the year? Because yeah. That's kind of how I feel about it. Like, it's like, I, you know, structurally speaking, there are better movies. There are movies that are cleaner. But it kind of, for all of its messiness and its shaggy dogness, I kind of appreciated the end result more than I have other movies that were more structurally sound.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think some of that is Martin McDonagh, as so far as a director,
mm-hmm.
Has such a quirky, dark sense of humor and sensibility.
Yeah,
that I think that's why I'm so much more willing to follow a movie that's going to take risks, and still deliver something really great,
mm-hmm.
Than just sort of a safe by the numbers crime drama.
Agreed. Yeah. And there's been so many we've seen that's really just follow templates. And this one is a surprise. You just never know where it's going to go.
No. And even if nothing else, it's worth it just for the three main character performances.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is I'm so on board with him as a writer director that I'm going to be eager for the next thing he puts out.
Yeah, same here. And I like that he takes his time. You know, like there's a good chunk of years between movies. That's like, I never feel like I'm getting sick of him.
No, and he's not being picked up to direct the newest Universal franchise clusterfuck.
Right.
He's just making movies he wants to make. I think he's a playwright as well.
Yeah. I get that vibe from him.
Yeah.
I think he might have directed plays before he did films.
I think so.
I don't know if we're making that up, but you know, Google us, fact check us.
Yeah. I don't know. Check him out.
Yeah. And you know, as a per recommendation, I would say definitely go back and look at In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths. I think both of those are really great movies for different reasons. If you really ended up liking this movie,
it has a lot more in common with In Bruges.
Yeah, it has a similar kind of sense of sorrow and experimentalism at the same time, but it's a bigger
and there's,
movie.
I think a lot more of Seven Psychopaths was played for laughs,
mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot more of In Bruges, I think, was... I remember when I first saw it, when it gets sort of the serious twist and reveal comes out on that,
uh-huh.
It's like, oh, holy shit. It's a gut punch.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that feeling from those movies, so...
Well, let's get into the Meyerowitz Stories, which was just released on Netflix. It's the new film written and directed by Noah Baumbach. We talked about Baumbach a little bit last week because we were discussing Lady Bird and his collaborations with Greta Gerwig.
Mm-hmm.
And the last three movies he's done, I guess not the last three because he did While We Were Young in between, but you know, he'd been working with her for a while and the collaboration heavy kind of stuff with Mistress America, Francis Ha and Greenberg. And here he's kind of returning to where he was sort of in the Squid and the Whale days or his collaborations with Wes Anderson. But this talks about a family, a sort of estranged family, who's gone different places, specifically these brothers Danny, played by Adam Sandler, and Matthew, played by Ben Stiller. And their father, played by Dustin Hoffman.
Don't forget their sister, Jean.
Yes. Jean, who kind of comes in intermittently through the film.
Mm.
And Dustin Hoffman is sort of... They all have sort of a complicated relationship with their father. They're very much in competition with each other. They think they're getting different kinds of affection from the patriarch that they sort of envy from the other. Danny, played by Adam Sandler, he is... recently going through a divorce, and he's going to be entering the job field for the first time because he's sort of been a stay-at-home dad all of his life. He's dropping off his daughter to Bard College, where his father was something of a hero there, an art person. During like the art boom of the 70s and 80s, he was a famous or semi-famous sculptor, sort of almost famous sculptor, who's sort of lost favor over the years. The family's planning on selling the house, but in the middle of this sort of tense moment when everyone's getting together, Dustin Hoffman's character Harold has an accident and is hospitalized, and of course this brings all of the family tensions up to the surface. The story's kind of told sort of in chapters, focusing on different characters or putting the center of consciousness into different characters as the movie's told along. What did you think of the Meyerowitz Project? Or the Meyerowitz Project, the Meyerowitz Stories, New and Selected.
I kind of, I went back and forth on this one a lot, like you just described that you did on Three Billboards.
Okay.
It's a really great character piece. It's, I would say it's nuanced to a fault.
That's interesting.
It's, again, it's very much an actor showcase.
Right.
And, man, is it great to watch these actors do their thing, as problematic as Dustin Hoffman may or may not be right now.
Yeah, he's sort of in, he's sort of in the news for other reasons. I don't want to go into that. Yeah, I agree. I agree. Yeah, I'm just saying.
I don't want to go into that, really. I'm just trying to, yeah. But his... stripping everything else away, his performance, which is all I want to talk about, was good in this.
Mm-hmm.
And same with Ben Stiller and Adam Sandler. Man, it's I forget how much I like it when Adam Sandler shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's great in it, I thought. Everyone is.
Yeah.
Emma Thompson is really great as Dustin Hoffman's newest wife.
Right.
Grace Van Patten as Adam Sandler's daughter is really great.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think it kind of trips on some indie movie sort of cliche.
Sure.
And it is a little overlong and kind of a little boring in some parts. And I think it over-ended the fuck out of itself.
Yes.
Like, this movie has more endings than Lord of the Rings, so people who complain about that, beware. So, yeah, I kind of went back and forth, because as a character study, I was really enjoying learning about these characters and their family, and it's very interesting.
Uh-huh.
But and I don't know if it's because of the way it was segmented. There was a point where I was like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, I think I'm there with you on this one. I think it's fine. I think, I kind of feel like this is Noah Baumbach coasting. Like,
yeah.
We've seen him do this stuff. We've seen him do it better. We've seen him, because he co-wrote Life Aquatic. There's a lot of similar stuff in there, as well as The Royal Tenenbaums, which he didn't co-write, but, you know, if we're looking at a movie about a family patriarch who problematic behavior sort of trickles down to the kids, both of those movies are doing this in a more interesting way, as well as Noah Baumbach's recent obsessions with sort of intergenerational relationships, which we've seen in While We Were Young, which was a movie I did not like. That was, like, one of my least favorite Noah Baumbach movies. But I think even in that movie, he approaches some of these ideas more in a more interesting way. I actually feel like this, like, segmentation, the sort of novelistic thing that he's doing in this movie, is sort of a gimmick just to dress up what is a pretty mundane, run-of-the-mill type of one of these sort of stories.
And maybe that's why it...
And I feel like if he was going to do that he could have done it. He could have committed to that a little bit more. And if he's really going to shift perspectives, like, first of all, why don't we get a lot more of their sister? Like,
yeah.
One of the reasons I forgot to mention her is because she's kind of just there. She has one little moment where she tells a pretty harrowing and weirdly prescient flashback story But then mm-hmm. that's really it that we get from her other than a few quirky window dressing pieces in the movie. And I think if we're going to play with this idea of structure, I think he could have maybe even broken it up more, maybe even play around with the timeline in a more interesting way.
And maybe that's why it kind of stood out to me, because I don't think it really did anything for the movie.
No, I think you could cut out those title cards and you wouldn't even notice it.
Yeah, and I also feel like there was some sort of snotty editing, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Like, there would be this thing that they would play a lot where the characters would be sort of rising in anger, and then it sort of cuts away in mid-scream.
Right, these hard cuts. Well, Noah Baumbach is a student of French New Wave. And a lot of that, sure. a lot of that stuff is where that's coming from, as no, well as Woody
and that's
Allen
fine.
Movies.
You know, it works to some extent, uh-huh. but after like the third time, I kind of was starting to roll my eyes. Like, uh-huh. I shouldn't be seeing your editing tricks the first time I'm watching a movie. You know what I mean?
Well, that kind of editing is purposely put in that way to be noticed.
But that's what I mean. When you hit that note over and over and over again, it gets kind of repetitive.
Well, and for me,
and
it's
a
more
little annoying.
Right. For me, it's more and to no effect. Like it.
Yeah.
It's,
exactly.
He does it just to kind of, I don't know. The only thing I could think thematically is that is he's kind of always reminding us of when he cuts in the middle of these like high dramatic points and then cuts to a more mundane scene, is to show that the repetitiveness of this type of argument that this family always has, that
sure,
they're
and
always kind
see.
Of running into these same problems, but they're always kind of glossed over. They just move on to the next thing because they're always sort of pushing these issues into the background.
I think there's definitely an argument to be made there.
Uh-huh.
It got a little grating to me. It was a little too self-aware.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how this movie felt for me in general.
It's just kind of stuffy and navel-gazing in a way that, I mean, Baumbach's one of those directors who and writers who, some of his stuff I love. Like, Greenberg, I think, is one of the best movies of the last 25 years. I think it's a masterpiece. Francis Ha is pretty close. The Squid and the Whale was this movie done right. I loved Squid and the Whale, the great, you know, one of the great indie films of the last whatever years as well. But then he does these movies like Margot at the Wedding or While We Were Young or this, where it's just these stuffy socialites with, you know, kind of complaining about their problems. And then like, he loves to write flawed characters, and he loves to write characters who try and pass off their flaws by explaining to you that they know what their problems are, and using it as a cop out.
And that's fine.
And sometimes that can be grating.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I mean, is I feel like if this movie had been a half hour shorter,
uh-huh.
I probably would have liked it a lot more. I think it just kind of stayed out its welcome.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of stuff I really did like. Mm-hmm. I really liked Adam Sandler's role. I thought he brought a great humanity to it, and
he's the most sympathetic character.
And it's just something that I haven't seen him do in a long time, so it's really refreshing. Whereas like Ben Stiller, you kind of know what you're getting with Ben Stiller. You're either getting goofy Ben Stiller or dramatic Ben Stiller.
And he's good in the movie. There's one scene in particular where, you know, he has a kind of pretty serious monologue, and it, you know, holds the camera on him, and it was very affecting. That was some really good directing. But
and I think they have some pretty great chemistry too, which mm-hmm. was kind of surprising. Like, I never thought that I would need to see Adam Sandler and Ben Stiller together.
They come from the same comedy world.
Well, they actually come from. They both come from comedy, but mm-hmm. they hadn't really crossed paths. Like, Ben Stiller had his own show and definitely always had his own sensibility, which was very different than the SNL world.
That's true, but Ben Stiller was in Happy Gilmore.
You're right.
As the orderly.
You're right. Huh. I didn't think about that. Anyway.
I think about that every time somebody asks me for something at work and I want to say...
You know what you could trouble me for is a glass of shut the hell up.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's true. He's sort of a gem in that. But they have really good chemistry together.
Yes.
And their relationship, I really enjoy. Again, it's just... I think the movie was a little overlong and a little self-aware. It's a movie, and it's frustrating because I think it could have been a bit more interesting because there is this sort of conversation about, you know, high art versus low art.
Sure.
And I think if maybe he was a little more self-aware with what he was doing, or maybe he was too self-aware. Maybe that was the problem. It could have been played to better effect.
I think, honestly, you know, after he has this screenplay and he's looking at it, I think he could have narrowed the scope a little. I think rather than telling every family member's story and trying to bring him in this big way, which, again, we've already seen him do this kind of thing, why not, like, I think, like, pick one of these stories or even just, like, incorporate them in a more tighter, succinct way.
Mm-hmm. Dial it in, yeah.
Yeah, it just needs to be narrowed because I felt like it gets so broad that after a while I kind of just like, I don't care anymore.
Yeah.
But yes, there's a lot of stuff in the movie I like. Individually, I kind of like everybody's little story. And, you know, Ben Stiller's great. I think Adam Sandler's great. I really like the stuff between Adam Sandler and his daughter and the grandpa.
Yeah.
I think that dynamic is really interesting. Her movies like killed me.
Yes. No, I agree. And that's what I mean. Like, I think if the movie had more of a conversation with itself about, you know, what is high art and low art, and like those moments really worked for me. And I think maybe if they had just focused on Adam Sandler's character. Like you said, it might have played a little more. Like, I don't think we needed to know as much about Ben Stiller. In fact, I think that kind of maybe diluted the tension between their relationship a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think maybe the movie wants to be about... I think the central relationship in the movie is between Ben Stiller and Adam Sandler, and it's about this brotherly rivalry between about getting their father's attention. But
now that you mention it, I think maybe that could have been maybe if we had just focused on one of them as a main character, it might have played a little better. I don't know.
Yeah,
my biggest thing is I think it was just a little too long and a little too self-indulgent.
Yeah, I would agree with that. There's better Noah Baumbach movies. This isn't a terrible one. I didn't hate it.
No.
But it feels minor to me.
And also, it is pretty long, so I think you kind of have to be in a mood for a slow burn.
It's not that long. It's only an hour and 52 minutes.
Yeah, but I felt it.
Yeah.
Like I said,
it should have been a 90-minute movie. Yeah.
Yes. And it absolutely could have been.
Okay, cool. Well, next week for the Netflix homework, I am going to assign us a famous Christmas comedy, The Ref, which I've never seen. All right. But, you know, it always comes up in greatest Christmas movie lists and that kind of stuff. So,
wait, you've never seen it?
No, have you?
No. I thought this was one of those ones where it was like you were making me watch this.
No. I need to see it myself. So there you go.
Fun.
All right. So did you want to direct anyone to your socials?
No. I mean,
I know I'm that tonight in San Diego is on hiatus right now, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of taking a little bit of a break myself just for it through the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
just because it's a lot of effort to do stuff.
Right.
So, I mean, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook at Keith Foster Kid. Yeah, but I don't know. I don't really have any shows coming up. I'm going to try to set some stuff up for next year.
Cool.
I probably won't do much throughout the rest of 2017 besides cry into a pillow.
Well, you have that to look forward to. You can follow me at VC Cassidy on Twitter. You can follow the show at Jabber Podcast. You can find the show at jabberandthedrone.podbean.com, where our RSS feed is, and links to all of the pod catchers such as Stitcher Radio, iTunes, Pocket Cast, Player.fm, and Google Play, and the Windows Podcast Network. You can also read my movie reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can read some of my content that I've done for the Seattle-based website, MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. And be sure to listen to our friends who do podcasts as well, including Rod and Denise at The Listening Party, Denise's solo podcast, The Mascot Diaries, Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational, and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics, and Bill and Brian of the Great Albums Podcast. They just had a massive album November, where they talk about albums that have sold millions and millions. That was a fun month. Check out Mike Fallick at his audio art project called Let's Start a Cult.
All right. And on that note, let's just give 2017 to Gosling. Give it to Gosling.
Bye.